Hello, listeners. This is Iris, and you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, April 8th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's jump right in and begin reading stories from the front page of the Courier today. The top one is titled, We Built This City. Strottman Building Center in Waverly shuts its doors. Maria Cooper wrote this story, and it begins with a photograph showing Fred Strottman and Kelly Denner posing outside the Strottman Building Center on Friday in Waverly. Dateline, Waverly, Iowa. A business that helped build the community from the ground up has closed after 110 years. Strottman Building Center at 625 5th Street Northwest in Waverly provided the town with lumber, paint, and other building supplies since 1914. It shut its doors on March 27th. The business provided materials to contractors and handymen, as well as making custom items such as cabinets and picture frames. It also was renowned for its paint matching. Most services were done without the use of computers. Fred Strottman, the grandson of founder Leslie Strottman, and Shelley Denner, the company's bookkeeper of 33 years, had been running the store alone since 2021. They said there were a multiple of reasons for closing, listing the pandemic, increasing costs, proximity of large home improvement stores, and changes in society. Strottman said he'd been contemplating it since autumn. Quote, I saw the handwriting on the wall, so they say, that things are going to have to change, he said. It's not a fun thing to go through, unquote. The 67-year-old said he wasn't ready to give up the family business he'd worked in since he was 13. Quote, things have just changed so much, it's a cultural thing. The younger people coming up, they don't do a lot of that kind of stuff themselves, he said. Our old customers, the do-it-yourselfers, the handymen, the contractors, they're retired or gone, dead, unquote. Both Strottman and Denner said with supply chain issues and being about 20 miles from Lowe's, Home Depot, and Menards, the competition was tough. Quote, we seem to be in an instant gratification society. People want it and go get it and don't care if it breaks and have to replace it, Denner said. Quote, I don't want to sound negative. The world is just different than when we started, unquote. That start began in 1914, when the business was called Friend Lumber Company, started by Leslie Strottman, Jake Bergen, and two others. The next year, the name was changed to Bergen Lumber Company. Leslie Strottman eventually purchased the company and ran it until his son Jim took over the business in 1969. Jim Strottman and his wife Jackie ran the store until 2011, when Fred Strottman took over as general manager. Fred Strottman purchased the building in 2020. From the late 1940s to the mid-1990s, Strottman estimated the company constructed about 450 houses. Most of these are in the neighborhoods located off on 12th Street, such as Hickory Heights and Country Meadows. Others are located in the areas near West Cedar Elementary School and Waverly Shellrock High School. Some houses were built in Denver, Cedar Falls, and nearby rural areas. Home construction stopped when the lead carpenter, Kenny Becker, had a stroke. The home construction heyday was briefly interrupted when the building center burned to the ground in 1977. Strottman said, coincidentally, the last customer on the day of the fire was a volunteer firefighter. While his father and the firefighter were talking, an electrical fire broke out, unbeknownst to them. The fire was so intense, Strottman said. Waverly's fire chief, who was out of town, could see the glow from Marshalltown. The chief followed the glow until he arrived in Waverly. The catastrophe didn't stop carpenters from working on the dozens of homes that were in the process of being built. Contractors donated lumber, and the crews worked out of Jim Strottman's back porch. The business started rebuilding the Strottman headquarters a week after the fire, and there was a grand opening 7 months later. The building was also devastated by the flood of 2008, when its basement was full of water from the Cedar River. The future of the structure on Fifth Street won't vary too much. Strottman sold the building to Cedar River Construction. Quote, "It would be heartbreaking if it were just going to sit empty, or, you know, somebody just wanted the property to tear it down," Denner said. Quote, "We're very happy it's going to be well-loved by the new guys," unquote. She said the thing she will miss the most is the personal connections that arose from providing business services. Quote, "It's going to leave a monumental hole for individual personal service," she said, tearing up. Quote, "A lot of our customers came in as customers and left as friends," unquote. That's the way the crumble cookies. Couple opens second Cedar Valley location in Viking Plaza in Cedar Falls. Andy Malone wrote this story, and it begins with a photograph showing corporate trainer Allie Morgan as she prepares cookie dough to be baked on Wednesday at the new Crumble location in Cedar Falls. She's got gloves on and has her hands in the dough, and we can see refrigerators in the background. The workers are wearing black with black aprons, and there are boxes of cookies seen on that counter. Dateline Cedar Falls. You can make every day a little bit better with a cookie. That's the philosophy that inspired a pair of Weston, Idaho farmers to open their second Crumble Cookies franchise in the Cedar Valley. Justin and Jennifer Roberts officially opened the shop at 8 a.m. Friday in the 400 suite at 421 Viking Plaza. It's one of fewer than 10 locations in Iowa. The franchise has more than 1,000 sites nationally, with stores in every state as well as Canada and Puerto Rico. Quote, "It was something different," Jennifer Roberts said about opening Crumble Cookies, known for its huge, shareable homemade gourmet cookies. The couple opened their original location at 1503 Flemang Drive in Waterloo in 2022. Quote, "We had people asking us about opening one in Cedar Falls," Robert said. They jumped at the opportunity to establish a store along the Viking Road corridor. Quote, "It's growing, and it's a great place to shop," she added. The Roberts took over the space, once the Inspire Boutique, between the Joint Chiropractic and RC Dermatology. It's a stone's throw from Culver's, Michaels, and Shields. Crumble will be open 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Saturday, with pickup, catering, and delivery through services like Uber Eats and DoorDash. No seating is available. Customers can order in-store, online, or on the app. Job applications are available online also. Crumble offers two familiar cookies every day, semi-sweet chocolate chunk and milk chocolate chip, but is known for rotating five flavors in and out amongst its more than 300 available. It mixes in other desserts on occasion, like mini pies, cakes, and cinnamon buns. Quote, "They're always coming up with something new," said Roberts, "and we're excited to see what comes next." Among the available flavors to kick off the opening days in Cedar Falls are classic pink sugar, chocolate cookies and cream, raspberry, butter cake, key lime pie, and oatmeal skillet. Quote, "It's all homemade and from scratch, the dough, frosting, and filling," Robert said. The Roberts hired Dominic Ximenez of Waterloo as manager in Cedar Falls to run the operation. They still live in Idaho and stop by the store only once in a while to check in. Ximenez and his team will bake hundreds of cookies a day and thousands per week. Quote, "We have a fun atmosphere," he said. "Our employees feel like friends and family, and we want to make sure the customer feels the same way." Allie Morgan, a corporate trainer, pointed out other attractive elements like its pink walls and the open kitchen concept. Quote, "We want you to feel like you're part of the whole process," noted Morgan. Several people were on hand for a VIP open house on Wednesday. Quote, "We love Crumble," said Jack Underwood of Cedar Falls, who works for the school district. She first tried crumble in Denver, Colorado, while visiting a daughter. She and another adult daughter, Courtney Underwood, and friend Leah Franklin are fans of the Waterloo site and are very, very excited about a store opening in Cedar Falls. The trio are fans of the cheesecake, chocolate chip, and French silk-flavored cookies. Quote, "They'll be a great addition to the Cedar Valley," said Franklin. Now turning the page, we come to the Cedar Valley section, and the first headline is, "Shootout charges dropped for killer headed to prison." The state drops the case after the suspect gets 55 years in prison for other crimes. Jeff Reinitz wrote this story. Dateline Waterloo. Authorities have dismissed charges against the Waterloo man involved in a 2020 gunfight that sent two people to the hospital. Prosecutors opted to drop intimidation and weapons charges against Robert Lee Williams Jr. in March after he was convicted of killing one man and trying to kill another in unrelated shootings. Williams, 34, had been charged for allegedly opening fire in the 2 a.m. August 2, 2020 battle that left at least 40 shell casings in the 100 block of Argyle Street. Chad Edward Lee was shot in the chest, and another person received a bullet wound to the leg in the shooting. Both survived. Chandrique Yarquez Day of Cedar Rapids was also charged in the case. Days before the Argyle Street shootout on July 31, 2020, police said Williams tried to kill Tony Campbell in an alley off West 6th Street, shooting Campbell in the face because he suspected him of harming his brother. Campbell survived. Then on August 15, 2020, Williams shot and killed Vincent Hemingway, 49, in an Adrian Street garage in what prosecutors said was a botched robbery. A jury found Williams guilty of voluntary manslaughter in Hemingway's death, and another jury convicted him of attempted murder and other charges in the face shooting. The convictions netted him up to 55 years in prison, and he will have to spend 22 years and 6 months behind bars before he is eligible for parole. Williams's brother, Raphael Rashi Williams, was convicted of robbery in the Adrian Street shooting, but the conviction was overturned on appeal, and he is awaiting a new trial. Two plead in 2021 Waterloo shooting. Filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline, Waterloo. Two Waterloo men have pleaded to reduced charges in a 2021 shooting that sent one person to the hospital. Ronald Frazier, 22, and Atarius Montel Goretzi Alexander, 27, pleaded to intimidation with a weapon. Sentencing will be at a later date. Authorities allege Alexander and Frazier chased Reginald Gwen Smith and shot him in the area of West 3rd and Randolph Streets at around 1:15 p.m. on August 11th of 2021. Smith suffered a gunshot wound to his leg, and officers found several spent 9mm shell casings in the street. Shortly after the shooting, police found the two at 188 West 10th Street and found two 9mm handguns between that address and the shooting scene, according to court records. West Union man fined $4,000 for littering. Jeff Reinitz wrote this story, and its dateline is West Union. A West Union man who allegedly turned the roadside into an impromptu dump is facing thousands of dollars in fines. We have a photograph here. It's in black and white, and kind of hard to distinguish what we're looking at, but the caption says, "Debris in a roadside ditch near Echo Valley State Park included box springs, beds, and several garbage bags." Fayette County Sheriff's deputies received a report about trash tossed into a ditch at Echo Valley and Imperial Roads near Echo Valley State Park on Sunday. The pile included box springs, beds, and several garbage bags. Deputies were able to trace the debris back to Christopher Lauren Ray Zucker, 38, of West Union, formerly of Waterloo, according to the sheriff's office. He was cited with 29 counts of littering on a highway, citations that resulted in $4,596 in fines. In comparison, dumpster rental usually runs around $400. Zucker was also ordered to return to the area and remove all the garbage in the presence of deputies, according to the sheriff's office. Old Wine Woman arrested in high-speed chase in Waterloo. Story written by Jeff Reinitz and the Dateline's Waterloo. An old wine woman has been arrested following a high-speed chase in Waterloo. Authorities said Ashley Nicole Torres drove down sidewalks, swerved around other vehicles, and hit speeds of up to 75 miles per hour in the 25-mile-per-hour zone during the pursuit. She also allegedly tossed contraband from the vehicle, and officers seized a large amount of cash, scales, bags of drugs, and 7 cell phones from inside the vehicle and along the chase path. Police arrested Torres, 35, on charges of eluding, possession of cocaine and marijuana with intent to deliver, violation of the Drug Tax Stamp Act, reckless driving, and interference. Bond for Torres was set at $60,000. Officers originally stopped Torres's Kia Niro around 1:30 a.m. Monday in the area of Conger Street and Logan Avenue for a burned-out brake light. She allegedly sped off when officers said they intended to search the vehicle because of the odor of marijuana. Torres is also charged on a February 12, 2024 search of a vehicle in the parking lot of Econo Lodge at 226 West 5th Street that yielded more than 50 grams of meth, according to court records. Man who shot into crowd near strip club gets prison. Another story by Jeff Reinitz and Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man who fired a gun outside a downtown strip club in 2022 has been sentenced to prison for weapons charges. Attorneys for O'Shea Taylor Wright, 27, had argued for leniency, noting that others had started the fight by punching him without provocation in front of Flirt's Gentlemen's Club on Jefferson Street. Prosecutors countered, noting that Wright shot into a crowd that was fighting. Judge Leonard T. Strand sentenced Wright to 5 years and 6 months in prison, to be followed by 3 years of supervised release on a charge of felon in possession of ammunition during a March 28 hearing in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids. According to court records, Wright and a woman were standing outside the club on December 31, 2022, when Jamail Lanier and other people approached them. The two began fighting Wright, who backed away. Others became involved in the fight, which began to shift toward a Lincoln MKX Wright had arrived in. Wright allegedly reached into the Lincoln's glove box, retrieved a pistol, and began firing. Wright was about 10 yards away from the group, prosecutors said. Lanier and Darius Davis were struck by bullets in the melee, but authorities didn't believe the bullets came from Wright's gun. And now the last one on this page. Jury rules Waterloo Strip Club unfairly used models' images. This is written by Jeff Reinitz, and the dateline is Waterloo. A federal jury has sided with a group of models that said a downtown Waterloo strip club unfairly used their likenesses for advertising. In a verdict handed down in March, jurors awarded the group of 16 models a total of $134,000 following trial in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids. The group took Charmed LLC, which operates Flirt's Gentlemen's Club, to court in May 2022, alleging the establishment used their photos in social media posts and internet content without approval. The suit was one of several targeting Iowa strip clubs. Jurors in the Flirt's case delivered a mixed verdict, largely finding in favor of the models for claims of false association, false advertising, unjust enrichment, negligence, and appropriation of right of privacy, which involves using a person's name, likeness, or image without their permission for commercial purposes. Jurors rejected claims that Flirts had violated plaintiffs' common law right of publicity and right of privacy through false claims. Attorneys for the models said the club harmed the plaintiffs' reputations by falsely representing them as exotic dancers affiliated with the establishment. According to court records, Flirts officials obtained images of the models through Facebook and Instagram. Tasty Takeover, UNI program lending exposure and opportunity to food entrepreneurs. Andy Malone wrote this story, and we have a color photograph showing Jadel Monet Boyd of Two Wavy Catering Services Food on Wednesday during the annual UNI Dining Takeover. And she has gloved hands, and she's holding a bowl with what appears to be scrambled eggs, and Jadel has some of it on her face. Dateline Cedar Falls. Food offers people the opportunity to socialize and celebrate. But there was more to the experience during the University of Northern Iowa's second annual Dining Takeover, when area entrepreneurs over 5 days shared dishes with African and African-American flavors at the Rialto Dining Center. Quote, "There's always so much love surrounding the food," said Lindy Roloff, T. Wayne Davis Chair in Entrepreneurship. "The cooks get more confident being around new people and learning how to reach new heights. At the same time, the UNI faithful is graciously exposed to new cuisine and culture." Quote, "The support and excitement is coming not from just family and friends, but people who they may not know," she said. Jadel Tutu Boyd of Two Wavy Catering participated in the event last year and now serves loaded nachos and other delicacies at the McLeod Center at the Unidome. In fact, she was on hand for the University of Northern Iowa versus University of Iowa basketball game when Caitlin Clark Mania came to town. On Wednesday, she returned to the Dining Takeover to serve loaded fries with brisket, chicken tenders, and macaroni and cheese. Quote, "I'm known for loading stuff up and giving out big portions," she said after going through 4 pans and approximately 40 servings. Since 2021, the 2003 Waterloo East High School graduate has served food for all types of events, from nachos and tacos to brisket sandwiches, pulled jerk chicken, chicken Alfredo, sub sandwiches, and chicken and waffles. The business was a side hustle while she worked as a paraeducator in the Waterloo Community School District. She used days off to cook and feed people. Quote, "I don't want to do the back and forth anymore, and this was always my dream, to employ myself," said Boyd. Her mother was her inspiration. It was not Mom's favorite pastime, but she told her daughter men like to eat. From there, Boyd would get in trouble by cooking $400 worth of food. Quote, "Wasting all the groceries eventually paid off," said Boyd. A fellow caterer, Kim Caldwell of Ms. Kim's Plates, participated Tuesday for the first time. She brought loaded baked potato with cheese, broccoli, and chicken to the dining hall. The 1985 Central High School graduate went through nearly 200 potatoes. Caldwell is all about dynamic combos. She likes to cook and eat good and healthy options. She'd been cooking for years before she started her business and was known for bringing the chitterlings and cornbread dressing. "I'd cooked for a lot of people, nephews, cousins, and friends, who'd always wanted certain stuff on certain holidays. I just figured I'd get in a little deeper," she said. Additionally, she'll make egg rolls, subs, gumbo, chicken, fish, and salads and soul food, anything she classifies as American and soul food. Like Boyd, she has big aspirations and wants to own a food truck this year. Quote, "It's about satisfying their taste buds for things they ask me to make for them," she said about what motivates her. The first 3 days of the takeover, March 25th, 26th, and March 29th, featured Erica Bedell of Daniel and Mom Kitchen with International Chew Rice and Gravy, Dominique Wallachin of Dominique's Seafood with Old Fashioned Southern Crab Broil, and Samuel Brandt of Salt and Peppa Catering with seared catfish, coleslaw, and spaghetti with meat sauce. Waterloo could collect 16% more in property taxes starting on July 1st. The story was written by Maria Cooper, and the dateline is Waterloo. The city proposes collecting 15.6% more in total property taxes, an increase of $7.1 million for the fiscal year starting July 1st. The city held a public hearing on the proposed tax levy for fiscal year 2025 on Monday night, the first of two hearings. The next is April 15th. Total city property tax collections are estimated at $52.2 million for fiscal year 2025. In fiscal year 2024, which ends on June 30th, collections were estimated at $45.2 million. The proposed property tax rate is $22.41 per $1,000 of taxable value. The current tax rate is 19.73. That's a 13.6% increase, or $2.68 higher than the current fiscal year. This is the maximum the city could tax. The proposed tax rates and askings could decrease before budgets are finalized on April 30th. Bridget Wood, the city's finance director, said the significant increase is because the city council gave her instructions to not use any money from the unassigned general fund. That fund is nearly $18.9 million, 28% of the entire general fund. Wood said the city tries to keep the unassigned fund balance at 15% to 30% of the total general fund. Quote, the more unassigned funds, the higher our bond rating can be, which results in lower interest rates, she said. It's a good thing to have a larger fund balance, and it gives you flexibility if anything were to come up, unquote. She noted the unassigned general fund could be used for emergencies such as natural disasters. Three residents spoke up at the public hearing against the increase. Glenn Anderkay, who also spoke at the Waterloo Community School District's budget hearing, said there's less money coming into taxpayers' pocketbooks this year, noting markets are going down and John Deere will soon lay off workers. Quote, you're going to tax people for more money in a time period when they're going to have less, he said. Resident Forrest Delavue also mentioned the increasing cost of living and proposed a solution. Quote, I think there's money out there that you can gather up from some of those tax increment finance districts, he said. Start sunsetting some TIFs. Start taking money out of them to run the budget, unquote. Tax increment finance districts provide incentives for developers, but money put into the districts stays there for years. Other residents said they were confused on how to read the mailing sent out by the county auditor. A recent law change requires counties to mail a statement to taxpayers with the numbers for proposed city, school district, and county budgets. However, the actual impact will likely be different than the examples in the statement because it does not factor in possible changes in assessed values. Many Blackhawk County property owners saw growth in assessed value in 2023. Wood said the only way taxpayers can determine their new tax bill is through an equation. Homeowners should take their new assessed value and multiply it by the rollback. Last year, the percentage of residential properties value that could be taxed dropped from 54.65% to 46.34%. A house with $100,000 assessed value would have a taxable value of $46,343. Residents should then divide that number by 1,000 and multiply by the tax rate for the county, city, and school district. That proposed number currently sits on $42.87. These calculations let residents predict their total tax bill. And now, listeners, we'd just like to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, April 8th on IRIS, that's I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now let's listen to this announcement.
As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
That's what we were taught, service before self.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
Now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial today is titled, Caitlin Clark Played on Boys' Teams. Why did Iowa pass a law to bench children from sports? This was written by Matt Sinovic and first appeared in the Des Moines Register. Matt Sinovic is the executive director of Progress Iowa, a statewide research and advocacy organization. When Caitlin Clark takes the court on the Final Four, millions will be watching. Clark has become a phenomenon to the point where her personal story is already the stuff of legend. She was always competitive, starting with games she played against her brother. Her parents added pavement to their driveway so she could practice longer shots. She scored 60 points in a single high school game. Caitlin Clark even played in a competitive AAU boys' league. There wasn't a similar option for girls, and Clark ended up leading her team to the state championship. Some of the other parents complained, but Clark was able to play, learn the game, and compete. It didn't matter whether she was a boy or a girl. If we fast break ahead to the year 2024, not every child in the state of Iowa has the same chance Clark did when she was younger. 2 years ago, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed a law telling kids which teams they can and can't play on. Reynolds's new law targets transgender girls, telling young athletes that now it matters whether players are a boy or a girl when it comes to sports. Policies like this fail to acknowledge the harmful implications they pose for the development and inclusion, or exclusion, of young athletes. It could particularly affect those who identify as transgender, who already experience depression, anxiety, and thoughts of suicide at alarmingly high levels. Ultimately, Iowa's transgender sports ban undermines the very essence of fair play and opportunity in sports that we should be teaching every child. And research shows that kids get far more from learning the skills of a sport, trying hard, and having fun than they do from winning. A good reminder for every youth coach and sports parent, too. What would have happened if Caitlin Clark didn't have the chance to play in that boys' AAU league? Would we all be watching as she keeps leading the Hawkeyes on a historic run? Would there be young girls and boys looking up to her and cheering her on across the country? We can't know the extent, but it certainly would have robbed her of that opportunity to develop as a player. And it would have robbed the boys in her league of the chance to learn that fair play and competition means the rules of the game are the same no matter what your gender is. Sports can provide so many opportunities for our kids. Not all of them can be the next Caitlin Clark on the court, setting records seemingly every night and redefining an entire sport. But giving kids every opportunity to grow and develop might help nurture the next Caitlin Clark of science, medicine, literature, or the next great teacher or coach in our own communities. If we want Iowa to be a place that fosters greatness like that of Caitlin Clark, we need to make a change. We need to preserve every opportunity for our children, regardless of their gender. No child deserves to be benched while they're still trying to learn their place in the game. Let's let the kids play. Matt Sinovic is the executive director of Progress Iowa, a statewide research and advocacy organization. Trump's Insatiable Bloodlust. Written by Maureen Dowd, this appeared in the New York Times on April 6th. An earthquake, an eclipse, a bridge collapse, a freak blizzard, a biblical flood. Donald Trump leading in battleground states. Apocalyptic vibes are stirred by Trump's violent rhetoric and talk of bloodbaths. If he's not elected, he bellowed in Ohio, there will be a bloodbath in the auto industry. At his Michigan rally on Tuesday, he said there would be a bloodbath at the border, speaking from a podium with a banner reading, quote, "Stop Biden's border bloodbath," unquote. He has warned that without him in the Oval, there will be an Oppenheimer-like doomsday. We will lose World War III, and America will be devastated by weapons the likes of which nobody has ever seen before. And the only thing standing between you and its obliteration is me, Trump said. An unspoken Trump threat is that there will be a bloodbath again in Washington, like January 6th, if he doesn't win. That is why he calls the criminals who stormed the Capitol hostages and unbelievable patriots. He starts some rallies with a dystopian remix of the national anthem, sung by the J6 prison choir, and his own reciting of the Pledge of Allegiance. The bloody-minded Trump luxuriates in the language of tyrants. In Macbeth, Shakespeare uses blood imagery to chart the creation of a tyrant. Those words echo in Washington as Ralph Fiennes stars in the thrilling Simon Goodwin production of Macbeth for the Shakespeare Theater Company opening Tuesday. Quote, "The raw power grab that excites Lady Macbeth and incites her husband to regicide feels especially pertinent now, when the dangers of autocracy loom over political discussions," Peter Marks wrote in the Washington Post about the production with Fiennes and Indira Varma, the lead sand snake in Game of Thrones. Trump's raw power grab after his 2020 loss may have failed, but he's inflaming his base with language straight out of Macbeth's Trip to Hell. Quote, "Blood will have blood," as Macbeth says. One of the witches, the Weird Sisters, urges him, "Be bloody, bold, and resolute," unquote. Another Weird Sister, Marjorie Taylor Greene, is predicting end times. Quote, "God is sending America strong signs to tell us to repent," she tweeted on Friday. Quote, "Earthquakes and eclipses and many more things to come. I pray that our country listens," unquote. Like Macbeth, Trump crossed a line and won't turn back. The Irish say, quote, "You may as well be hanged for a sheep as a lamb," unquote. The Washington Post's Josh Dowsey reported that since Trump put his daughter-in-law in charge of the Republican National Committee, prospective employees are asked if they think the election were stolen. Republicans once burbled on about patriotism and defending America. Now, denying democracy is a litmus test for employment in the formerly grand old party. My Irish immigrant father lived through the cruel "no Irish need apply" era. I'm distraught that our mosaic may shatter. But Trump embraces Hitler-esque phrases to stir racial hatred. He has talked about immigrants poisoning the blood of our country. Last month, he called migrants animals, saying, quote, "I don't know if you call them people in some cases. They're not people, in my opinion," unquote. Trump's obsession with bloodlines has instilled by his father, the son of a German immigrant. He thinks there is good blood and bad blood, superior blood and inferior blood. Fred Trump taught his son that their family's success was genetic, reminiscent of Hitler's creepy faith in eugenics. Quote, "The family subscribes to a racehorse theory of human development," the Trump biographer Michael D'Antonio told PBS. Quote, "They believe that there are superior people and that if you put together the genes of a superior woman and a superior man, you get a superior offspring, unquote. Trump has been talking about this as far back as an Oprah show in 1988. The Gene Believer brought it up in a 2020 speech in Minnesota denouncing refugees. Quote, "A lot of it is about genes, isn't it? Don't you believe?" he told the crowd about their pioneer lineage, adding, quote, "The racehorse theory. You think we're so different? You have good genes in Minnesota," unquote. As Stephen Greenblatt writes in Tyrant, Shakespeare on Politics, usurpers don't ascend to the throne without complicity. Republican enablers do all they can to cozy up to their would-be dictator, even introducing a bill to rename Dulles Airport for Trump. Democrats responded by introducing a bill to name a prison in Florida for Trump. Quote, "Why, in some circumstances, does evidence of mendacity, crudeness, or cruelty serve not as a fatal disadvantage, but as an allure, attracting ardent followers?" Greenblatt asks. Quote, "Why do otherwise proud and self-respecting people submit to the sheer effrontery of the tyrant, his sense that he can get away with saying and doing anything he likes, his spectacular indecency? Like Macbeth's castle, the Trump campaign has, as Lady Macbeth put it, the smell of blood, and all the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten it." From the New York Times, "Why Are Older Americans Drinking So Much?" by Paula Spann. The phone awakened Doug Norman at 3 a.m. A surgeon was calling from a hospital in Grand Junction, Colorado, where Mr. Norman's father had arrived at the emergency room, incoherent and in pain, and then lost consciousness. At first, the staff had thought he was suffering a heart attack, but a CT scan found that part of his small intestine had been perforated. A surgical team repaired the hole, saving his life. But the surgeon had some questions. Quote, "Was your father an alcoholic?" he asked. The doctors had found Dean Norman malnourished, his peritoneal cavity awash with alcohol. The younger Mr. Nordman, a military personnel finance author living in Oahu, Hawaii, explained that his 77-year-old dad had long been a classic social drinker, a scotch and water with his wife before dinner, which got topped off during dinner, then another after dinner, and perhaps a nightcap. Having 3 to 4 drinks daily exceeds current dietary guidelines, which define moderate consumption as 2 drinks a day for men and 1 for women or less. But that was the normal drinking culture of the time, said Doug Nordman, now 63. At the time of his 2011 hospitalization, though, Dean Nordman, a retired electrical engineer, was widowed, living alone, and developing symptoms of dementia. He got lost while driving, struggled with household chores, and complained of a slippery memory. He had waved off his 2 sons' offers of help, saying he was fine. During that hospitalization, however, Doug Nordman found hardly any food in his father's apartment. Worse, reviewing his father's credit card statements, quote, "I saw recurring charges from the liquor barn and realized he was drinking a pint of scotch a day," he said. Public health officials are increasingly alarmed by older Americans drinking. The annual number of alcohol-related deaths from 2020 through 2021 exceeded 178,000, according to recently released data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more deaths than from all drug overdoses combined. An analysis by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism shows that people over 65 accounted for 38% of that total. From 1999 to 2020, the 237% increase in alcohol-related deaths among those over age 55 was higher than for any age group except 25 to 34-year-olds. "Americans largely fail to recognize the hazards of alcohol," said George Koob, the director of the Institute. Quote, "Alcohol is a social lubricant when used within the guidelines, but I don't think they realize that as the dose increases, it becomes a toxin, he said. And the older population is even less likely to recognize that. The growing number of older people accounts for much of the increase in deaths, Dr. Koob said. An aging population foreshadows a continuing surge that has healthcare providers and elder care advocates worried, even if older people's drinking behavior doesn't change. But it has been changing. The proportions of people over 65 who report using alcohol in the past year, about 56%, and the past month, about 43%, are lower than for all other groups of adults. But older drinkers are markedly more likely to do it frequently, on 20 or more days a month, than younger ones. Moreover, a 2018 meta-analysis found that binge drinking, defined as four or more drinks on a single occasion for women, five or more for men, had climbed nearly 40% among older Americans over the past 10 to 15 years. What's going on here? The pandemic has clearly played a role. The CDC reported that deaths attributable directly to alcohol use, emergency room visits associated with alcohol, and alcohol sales per capita all rose from 2019 to 2020 as COVID arrived and restrictions took hold. Quote, a lot of the stressors impacted us, the isolation, the worries about getting sick, Dr. Koob said. They point to people drinking more to cope with that stress. Researchers also cite a cohort effect. Compared to those before and after them, the boomers are a substance-using generation, said Keith Humphreys, a psychologist and addiction researcher at Stanford. And they're not abandoning their youthful behavior, he said. Studies show a narrowing gender divide, too. Women have been the drivers of change in this age group, Dr. Humphreys said. From 1997 to 2014, drinking rose an average of 0.7% a year for men over 60, while their binge drinking remained stable. Among older women, drinking climbed by 1.6% annually, with binge drinking up 3.7%. Quote, contrary to stereotypes, upper middle class educated people have higher rates of drinking, Dr. Humphreys explained. In recent decades, as women grew more educated, they entered workplaces where drinking was normative. They also had more disposable income. The women retiring now are more likely to drink than their mothers and grandmothers, he said. Yet alcohol use packs a greater wallop for older people, especially for women, who become intoxicated more quickly than men because they're smaller and have fewer of the gut enzymes that metabolize alcohol. Seniors may argue that they are merely drinking the way they always have, but, quote, equivalent amounts of alcohol have much more disastrous consequences for older adults, whose bodies cannot process it as quickly, said Dr. David Oslin, a psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania and the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Philadelphia. Quote, it causes slower thinking, slower reaction time, and less cognitive capacity when you're older, he said, ticking off the risks. Long associated with liver diseases, alcohol also exacerbates cardiovascular disease, renal disease, and, if you've been drinking for many years, there's an increase in certain kinds of cancers, he said. Drinking contributes to falls, a major cause of injury, as people age, and disrupts sleep. Older Americans also take a lot of prescription drugs, and alcohol interacts with a long list of them. These interactions can be particularly common with pain medications and sleep aids, like benzodiazepines, sometimes causing oversedation. In other cases, alcohol can reduce a drug's effectiveness. Dr. Oslin cautions that while many prescription bottles carry labels that warn against using those drugs with alcohol, patients may shrug that off, explaining that they take their pills in the morning and don't drink until evening. quote, those medications are in your system all day long. So when you drink, there's still that interaction, he tells them. One proposal for combating alcohol misuse among older people is to raise the federal tax on alcohol for the first time in decades. Quote, alcohol consumption is price sensitive, and it's pretty cheap right now relative to income, Dr. Humphrey said. Resisting industry lobbying and making alcohol more expensive, the way higher taxes have made cigarettes more expensive, could reduce use. So could eliminating barriers to treatment. Treatments for excessive alcohol use, including psychotherapy and medications, are no less effective for older patients, Dr. Oslin said. In fact, age is actually the best predictor of a positive response, he said, adding that treatment doesn't necessarily mean you have to become abstinent. We work with people to moderate their drinking, unquote. But the 2008 federal law requiring health insurers to provide parity, meaning the same coverage for mental health, including substance use disorders, as for other medical conditions, doesn't apply to Medicare. Several policy and advocacy groups are working to eliminate such disparities. Dean Nordman never sought treatment for his drinking, but after his emergency surgery, his son moved him to a nursing home where antidepressants and a lack of access to alcohol improved his mood and his sociability. He died in the facility's memory care unit in 2017. Doug, whom his father had introduced to beer at 13, had been a heavy drinker himself, to the point of blackout as a college student and a social drinker thereafter. But as he watched his father decline, quote, I realized this was ridiculous, he recalled. Alcohol can exacerbate the progression of cognitive decline, and he had a family history. He has remained sober since that pre-dawn phone call 13 years ago. Waterloo Bucks to host gathering April 10th to recruit host families for the season. Dateline Waterloo. The Waterloo Bucks are looking for host families for the 2024 season. A casual information get-together will take place from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on April 10th at the Other Place on University Avenue. Anyone who would like to learn more about the Bucks host family program may attend. Bucks front office members, along with current host families, will be on hand to answer questions. Pizza and beverage will be courtesy of the Bucks. The Bucks are a summer collegiate baseball team that recruits college players from all over the United States to form a 35-man roster every year. These players call the Cedar Valley home from late May until mid-August. Players represent the Cedar Valley by playing 70 games over 76 days. The Bucks provide players with housing through the Bucks Host Family Program. Families receive numerous benefits, including season tickets, year-round invite-only events, souvenir shop discounts, the ability to have their children be bat boys and bat girls during Bucks games, and more. Families or individuals interested in housing a Bucks player can also call General Manager Dan Corbin at area code 319-232-0500, extension 2, or email Corbin at waterloobucks.com. Season tickets, coupon books, and group outings for the 30th season of Bucks baseball are available by calling area code 319-232-5633. Now we turn to the In the News column, voter fraud sentencing. Kim Taylor, a Sioux City woman convicted of 52 counts of voter fraud, will serve 4 months in prison and 4 months of house arrest. Throughout 2020, Taylor filled out and signed ballots on behalf of Vietnamese residents with limited English proficiency in order to influence votes for her husband, who was elected to a Woodbury County Board of Supervisors position that fall after losing a U.S. House primary election. Taylor faced a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison for each of the 52 counts. The judge cited Taylor's lack of criminal history and her role as caretaker for 6 children and her mother as reasons for the lighter sentence. Taylor will also have to pay a $5,200 fine. Next, man charged for 35-year identity theft. A former University of Iowa hospital employee has pleaded guilty to an extensive identity theft scheme in which he had been living under another man's name for more than 30 years, causing the other man to be falsely imprisoned and sent to a mental hospital. Matthew David Kierens, 58, was convicted of crimes punishable by up to 32 years in prison. Hemp regulations pass. Iowa Senate lawmakers passed a bill regulating the THC content and sale of hemp products, sending the bill to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk for a signature. The bill would cap the THC content of hemp products at 4 milligrams per serving and 10 milligrams per container, and impose civil and criminal penalties on non-compliant businesses. And finally, Reynolds signs Religious Freedom Bill. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed a bill this week that will give more legal protections to people who claim their religious liberty has been infringed. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, modeled after legislation in other states, requires courts to apply strict scrutiny, the highest legal standard, in religious liberty cases. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, April 8th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can access a recording of today's reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.